Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, welcome to part two of our delightful chat with Michael Stipe. If you haven't heard part one yet, stop what you're doing. Go back to the feed, find part one, listen there, and then come back here for part two. Here's part two. I feel like we're talking about two things, both of which are crystallized in your book. So we've got COVID, and that has changed the world in a massive way.
Yeah.
It's paused the world in a massive way. I do fear that people will forget it and actually... it won't change anything. That's my fear.
Oh.
But then we're also talking about just a word that's come up a few times is privilege.
Yeah.
And the way in which we are all waking up to, for me, I feel long overdue, the fact that there is so much inequality that I have, through being a white gay man, have been able to skip past. And, you know, if I think of myself 15 years ago, I was never talking about any of the stuff that I talk about now. And I wonder what you, as an artist, feels that does for you, and how you feel you must represent it in whichever medium you're working in at the time.
I think accepting the truth of that, and then allowing humility, allowing humility. I think that's really important. To be able to say, I don't know everything. I don't know the experience of that. I can empathize. I can try to imagine, but I will never know what it feels like to be this person or that person. But there is a basic humanity that we all carry within ourselves. The book is also very much about feminine energy. And that's very much where I think we're headed. If we actually survive, and I think I'm an optimist. I do think that we will survive. I don't think that COVID is going to be forgotten. We differ on that. I think it's going to be with us for a very long time, and hopefully minimized. Hopefully it'll be something that's quite controllable. But you know, these are scary things and scary times that we're talking about. But we're making these magnificent leaps forward culturally, in terms of acknowledging privilege, acknowledging what it is to be born white and to be born cis male, whether we're queer or not, or gay or not, or however we identify. We're something that is not something else. And to be able to empathize with, to be able to approach that with an amount of humility, for me, falls into what this book started as, which was this celebration of feminine energy. And by feminine, I don't mean born with a vagina. I mean that energy that we all have within ourselves, my ability as a male to acknowledge that in myself and to actually recognize it as a performer and as an artist, as a superpower, to say that vulnerability allowed me as a 20-year-old to be the public figure that I became, representing something that was very, very different from what had been represented before, and very off the mark from what was being represented by my generation. And so I'm very proud of that, you know, but,
yes.
But moving away from me, not about me, that feminine energy is where I think we're shifting. You know, it's the age of Aquarius. I mean, I'm a total hippie, Chris. So I'm gonna like, you know, I'll reference all that stuff and I'll burn all the incense I want, to support my ideas. They don't have to apply universally, you know, but that's my particular church. That's where I think we're headed. And again, I'm an optimist, so I feel like it's not all doom and gloom, and it's not all scary and sad. There are beautiful, incredible moments within the struggle of arriving at that place. We have to honor all of it.
And talking about femininity, I'll bore listeners going on about this again, but it's one of the things I speak about a lot, is that I think I don't think people cared that I was gay so much. What made people cross was that I was feminine. And I related to women and girls from the moment I can remember anything.
Right,
I was
right.
Like, these are my people. I like hanging out with them. I want to be with them. And boys, I was like, don't really get it. I mean, that's generalizing, but you know what I mean. And yeah. And I thought, and it was very much taught to me a lot that that wasn't allowed. Why are you doing that? Why are you doing that?
Right.
And one of the things I've loved through this podcast is talking to people like Courtney Act, the drag queen, about how you learn to live with your femininity and your masculinity, and how every single version of that, no matter what you feel inside yourself, is correct and right. And, you know, I adore that. And I think of myself, if I was 14 now, I wonder what I would say I identify as. Because I feel like being a gay man was like, oh, well, that's a club, which I get. I'll join that. But I think I would have the words to say I was probably gender fluid. I was probably, you know, this, that, the other. Like, there's so much more nuance is what I'm saying. And I adore that, because that has been around. That nuance has been around since the dawn of time. This is not new. It's just somehow it got lost for a period. And I wondered if you felt that as well, and if you wished there had been more nuance at the time when you were 20, for example.
Well, there might have been. It got shut down. I mean, I think what was called gay liberation in the 1970s was on the verge of emerging following the feminist movement of the early 1970s, and racial justice to following the great example of Martin Luther King, and an acknowledgement and a recognition in my country that that there were a lot of things between, particularly black and white, there were a lot of racial issues that needed to be dealt with. And so next in line was the queers. And so I was 15 in 1975. All the signs were there that, not about me, but I mean, that they were there too, by the way, but it was all writ large. You could see it all, but it got shut down by politics in this country, and then by AIDS, HIV/AIDS. And it took a backseat for a very long time. So we finally arrived at this place where the fluidity, and something that I've been talking about from the very beginning, that I never identified with these very binary ideas of what is and of what is and what should be, or what, these very kind of black and white binary things were for me never, ever made sense. And so I've been talking about that for a long, long time. I'm glad that we find ourselves here. I'm glad that we're in a place where that conversation is. And I don't know. I mean, to answer your question, really, if I was 14 in 2021, I probably might also be somewhere in that gender fluid, or I don't really know. I have no idea. I use the word queer because it just described for me something that didn't fit into any of the available categories when I was trying to define myself. And now it's changed. That, you know, that has of course changed. But I think of queer as a kind of umbrella term. And as we were talking about earlier, you know, now it's become really, it's more about what I was saying about religion or about belief systems. You know, you pick and choose from, you know, if we embrace or acknowledge that each of us, one, we contain multiples, we contain multitudes, we contain platitudes. Mm. What is it? It's not, who am I quoting here? Is it Thoreau? We contain multitudes. It's not Thoreau. It's what's his name? Walt Whitman. Good old Walt Whitman from Brooklyn, New York said, we contain multitudes, or I contain. If we acknowledge that, then we can pick and pull from the best of all those things that we can be and put together. Who is Chris? Who is Michael? Who are you? Who am I? How do we find common ground? How do we carry on a conversation, or how do we embrace our differences and acknowledge what the beauty of those, and then find a common ground so that we can march forward together, so we can go into the future, you know, not holding hands and skipping and singing tra-la-la, but with some level of equality and I don't know, happiness. What, you know, what's so
harmony, I suppose, isn't it?
Harmony. Thank you. Harmony. All the good H words. Yeah. Harmony and happiness.
Yeah. we're talking about there's more words, there's more language that people understand and accept, and that feels like a place you were in a long time ago, a place that you knew what you were, and you just, you know, that's why you said queer, because that worked for you, because perhaps other people's labels weren't working for you. And I remember that you have said, correct me if I'm wrong, that actually you never had any pressure from anyone in your workspace to define who you were or hide who you were or anything. But, you know, did you... I always felt, and this is coming from my, you know, a younger person, I felt that there was always something enigmatic about you, of how you defined. And I wondered if you felt annoyed by that, or that was a deliberate thing.
That's so interesting that you bring that up. I think the term enigmatic was straight media's way of acknowledging my queerness without saying it out loud. And I think that that term, I became the eccentric guy or the enigmatic guy.
Yes.
Yeah. In the workplace, I mean, my band knew from when I was 20 years old, we all moved in together. There was no hiding who I was sleeping with, who I was looking at across the bar at the end of the night. So that was all there. They knew everything from the very beginning, but I didn't speak about it for a long time because it was, for me, really, it was more of a privacy issue. And then it became ridiculous not to speak about it. And I started speaking publicly about my sexuality when I was 34, which is very late in life, certainly by today's standards. But that's when I needed to, that's when I felt like safe enough, I guess, to be able to acknowledge publicly what I thought was, I mean, anyone who didn't notice at that point was, you know, they were wearing blinders, because it was pretty fucking obvious that I wasn't your regular straight, like white pop singer. That was never there.
No. And if you were doing all of that now, would you feel that you had to say, because you had to represent in a way that back then, I don't feel artists felt the same compulsion in some respects?
No. When I spoke publicly, the only other people in my field that had spoken about their sexuality as queer people were Katie Lang and Boy George. That was it. I think around the same, that was it. Around the same time, Bob Mould from the band Husker Du spoke about his sexuality. But no, you know, it was another 4 years before Ellen DeGeneres, or before George Michael got arrested in Los Angeles in a bathroom. Bless his heart. And he was a sweet guy. I actually met him a few times. He was super nice, and obviously very talented.
Yeah, a talent and a beautiful man who was, you know, vilified for being who he was. And it was horrendous what the press did to him.
Oh, well, yeah.
I might not have
been in Britain at that time, but I thought his approach was kind of funny and cool, like the way he embraced.
I mean, just so classy and intelligent and funny and fuck you from the very core, which I loved. But I think that, you know, I lament those times of the way that he was treated for being, when the, you know, mainstream British press identified him as gay, you know, he became a sexual predator. You know, that they painted him as such, and it's a real shame. And
well, that's the dailies in Britain. You're going to get that, aren't you? You know, you're going to have a tough skin to live through that, for sure.
But I remember there being a period around AIDS and HIV in New York that there was a real witch hunt vibe going on for anyone with HIV and AIDS, and how it was portrayed. But particularly around you, there was a lot of talk. And how do you feel about that time? And
it was upsetting. It was very, very upsetting to me that people were talking and writing about me being sick. And I thought that it was a not very subtle way for them to try to out me. And I didn't feel like, I mean, again, I had my own reasons for not speaking publicly about my sexuality. Basically at the time I was 32 when this was going on, I was wearing hats saying White House Stop AIDS. And I was, talking about, you know, but I ran away from, I'm immensely fearful. And so AIDS terrified me. It hit way too close to home for me to be able to become a member of ACT UP or whatever. And I have friends who were I have friends now who were early members of founding members of ACT UP, you know, that were there right at the very beginning. But I just kind of ran the other direction because of fear, to tell you the truth. Then I felt like privacy. I felt like I gave so much of who I was as a performer and as a writer and in interviews. I wanted to keep something for myself. And the times that I had tried to speak about my sexuality, the blowback from the gay community was more tremendously horrible to me than from the straight community, frankly, because I don't identify as gay. I was somewhere in between and they just didn't want to hear that, you know, and for good reason. I understand that some people had a much different struggle than I did, growing up. And I now understand that a lot of those people were truly concerned for my health and worried that I was sick. And there was no cure for AIDS at the time, and people were dying a lot, and they were dying a lot here in New York where I was staying. It was horrendous. It was really awful. I lost a lot of people. We all did.
I think it's really important to note that what happened then was unacceptable, I suppose. And I'm pleased that I don't think it would happen now.
Politically, you mean, in terms of AIDS, in terms of HIV/AIDS, or what?
I think I'm talking personally about you, actually.
Oh, sorry.
But also, what we've spoken about a lot in recent months on this podcast, actually, is how the whole HIV was dealt with. Was completely unacceptable. And I don't know if you've seen It's a Sin, Russell T. Davies' show.
I haven't seen it yet. I've read all about it.
I think you would love it. Mm. One of the things that he wanted to pull out in that show was that a lot of gay men were the people who also denied HIV in his experience living through that time in England. You know, that people were saying, oh, no, it's a rumor. You know, it's not real, because they were in denial. It was a fascinating new slant.
Oh, no, I knew it was real. I knew it was real before anyone else did, because of spending so much time in New York. I remember the first, I still look up at these, it's when Klaus Nomi died, and I'd seen Klaus Nomi perform when I was 19. I came to New York with Peter Buck, my former band's guitar player and one of my best friends, and three other people. And we hung out in a van, slept on the street, and went around to all these clubs at the time. And I saw Klaus Nomi perform, in fact, and it was just mind-blowing to see this guy do his thing. It was incredible, just incredible. In this tiny club with maybe, there might have been 100 people in it. It was astonishing. But I remember looking up at the billboard that memorialized his death and the sadness of that. This was very early days, Chris. I think it was maybe I remember reading about AIDS before it was called AIDS and being like, oh, holy shit, this is not good. And feeling very scared for myself, because I was very sexually active, and I was very sexually active in a lot of the places that were really hit hardest by AIDS. You know, I was 27 I was 22 at that point. I think it was 1982 is when I became aware of it. I was 27 before I was able to get an anonymous HIV test. And then I was 34 when I spoke publicly about my sexuality. So there's a lot in between that tells a way different story, you know, but there's a lot of sadness there. And going through COVID now, I mean, I feel like I have PTSD, frankly, from having lived through AIDS, as someone in their 20s in the 1980s. And as an army brat, also having lived through Vietnam with my father and my family, you know, but AIDS in particular, I feel my reactions and responses to COVID and to the rules and regulations that have been set out to protect everyone. There's definitely some fear there coming from living through the 1980s and living through AIDS. I wasn't sick, by the way. I'm negative. I don't think we said that. I'm negative. I was then. I am now.
Yes.
One of my heroes in the book is actually one of my heroes in the book was one of the people that, you know, Dallas Buyers Club.
Yes.
Yeah. So this person was pretty much that, like figuring out ways to get AIDS medication to people at a point where it was experimental medication, and she's now a great friend and a tremendous hero of mine. So she made it into the book.
Tell me her name for the listeners so we can all have a Google.
Her name is Ivy Arce.
Ah, okay, yes.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
One thing I wanted to ask you, which you spoke about in your voice notes, which come with the book, which are beautiful, is I think I heard you say a couple of times about being in the moment. And I feel like that's something that's really important to you. And I wondered what that is, I suppose, and where that comes from.
Being in the moment. Well, first I can say thank you to you and Alan, because listening to your podcast and a few others, gave me the courage to actually do the audio, the spoken voice audio that helps. You know, the last thing I wanted actually was to be enigmatic and to be eccentric. I really, when I create things, I really feel like as a songwriter, certainly conceptualizing videos for and with a band, and then making books or doing the artwork that I do on outside of photography, I never want to be difficult to understand. I want all people to feel smart when they look at or hear something that I've done and feel like they can connect with it emotionally or otherwise, hopefully emotionally, but at least otherwise. And so to be able to provide a little bit of a walking tour with my voice through the book, I have you guys to thank for that, because it was really listening to your podcast and a couple others, as I mentioned, that gave me the courage to do that. So thank you. I want to say thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, I really mean it. I admire you guys a great deal. And so thank you for that. In terms of being in the moment, I just, as I mentioned earlier, I from performing, and from being hyperactive as a child, having this very adrenalized state, it doesn't do any favors for memory. And so allowing myself to be in the moment is not something that comes easily. Well, you know what? The truth is, maybe it does come easily to me, but I don't recognize it when it's there. And then I want it. I want to be there, but I'm always thinking about, my mom calls it monkey brain. One of our great friends who was a yoga instructor, and he's now sadly passed. He was the first love of my life, Jeremy Ayres, was my mom's yoga instructor years later, and a great dear friend of the family. But Jeremy always referred to my mom as having monkey brain. And that's where you're thinking about all these different things at one time, and you can never focus or settle on one thing. I try to eliminate that and really be there. I have trouble speaking and formulating my thoughts and putting them into words. And so, and I speak in this, as you've now figured out, if you never knew before, in this very cyclical way. I always do land where I intended to go, but it can get really boring in the middle.
Oh, it's not boring. It's great.
Thank you. You're generous. Very generous.
No, it's you speak in this way that is so kind of warm and kind and inclusive and in the moment, actually, I think.
Wow.
But I think it's something that I have definitely, I could relate to, because I've always tried to do that, and I'm definitely very monkey brain. And, you know, there's always 5,000 things going on. And actually, it's kind of one thing I love about, for example, doing this podcast, because it's two people talking and you just go, you know, and that's all that's going on. Or, weirdly, my other job is I'm a director, and actually, it's so focused directing. It's actually quite a nice break. And I think there's something about photography, because my dad was a fashion photographer, that is about being in the moment. But also, I think that there's something about taking pictures that I wondered if you can relate to, which is that you are in the moment and you're in the thing, but you're also slightly not there. So Murray Hill, who we interviewed, the drag king from New York was saying that
he's amazing.
Murray, yeah, he's amazing. Murray went to New York and actually used taking photographs as their access point to getting into this world, which they were sort of slightly afraid of. And I think I'm getting Murray's pronoun right, being they. Did you ever use photography as an access point to worlds which you knew you wanted to enter, but you were slightly afraid of, in the way that I heard Murray say that Murray did? And I sort of was interested by that.
The answer would be yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it also, you know, there's a... It's probably, yeah, I'm going to say it's following Warhol, but who plays a huge, you know, that's a big part of my understanding of how things are and how they should be in terms of art, is through Andy Warhol, who I consider to be the greatest artist of the 20th century. But the idea of having this recording device with you at all times and actually using it. And I'm so glad now that I was taking all those pictures, because I look back and I'm like, what a life I've had. What people I've met. Like, some of them, it's like, it's one night and you're there and it's gone and you're moving. It's like that movie with, I think it's Leonardo DiCaprio. I think it's a Woody Allen movie called Celebrity. And it's just going from one thing to another, to another, to another, to another. And you're picking up people along the way. And half of them are, half of them are world renowned and the other half are not. And everyone's just kind of like, whoa, it's one ongoing party. That's, I look at my life through the images that I took, and I'm so glad I took those pictures, because I'm like, wow, man, I have been to some incredible places and I've met some incredible people, and I've had access to, you know, just, let's say, proximity. Let's not even suggest that there's a relationship or a friendship there, but just in terms of simple proximity, I've had access to some of the greatest minds and some of the greatest artists of our time. Sometimes they offer me advice, and sometimes I remember it. How about that?
What has been some of the best advice you've been given? I have to ask that question.
Patti Smith told me, when I was approaching a very, very difficult project with my former band. This was back in 1998 or 99. We had been friends for a couple of years at that point. She told me I needed to walk unafraid. And I actually took I said, can I have that phrase? Can I have that? And she said, yeah, it's yours. And I wrote the song Walk Unafraid, which then became a LGBTQIA kind of clarion call of that time for a lot of the fans that were seeing us perform live. That became their song, because it really spoke of being an outsider, feeling overwhelmed by the amount of things that are really in culture and in life kind of against you. But feeling strong enough to embrace the beauty of who you are and what you are, and just kind of running with that.
Wow.
And so I wrote that song, Walk Unafraid. Trust your instinct. That's another really good one.
Yes. That's so lovely. And Patti, when Patti came on this podcast, she gave Alan a beautiful piece of advice, which was, he was saying that he was frightened of doing this dance piece that he's doing.
Right.
And she just said, but Alan, if you try your best, that's all you can do. I think it was something like that. And it was just like, yeah, absolutely. That's really simple, actually. You try your best, that's all you can do.
Done. And spoken from, you know, the mouth of the sensei. I mean, who could speak better about literally jumping feet first into any situation she finds herself in, completely unafraid. She's fearless. And that's, again, I mean, not to circle back over and over again to the book, but it's that fearlessness that I was searching for when I decided to include most of or all of the people in the book, that fierceness, that individuality, that embracing of our vulnerability, of our insecurities as superpowers. And I'm actually quoting, this is great advice. In fact, Greta Thunberg, I think, referred to her being on the spectrum as a superpower. And I was like, whoa, this is coming from a, how old is she? 16-year-old?
I don't know how old she is. It's like 16.
Yeah. A young woman referring to autism, her being on the spectrum as a superpower. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm not autistic, but I've got superpowers too. And one of my superpowers is my vulnerability and my acknowledging that instinctually from the point of, from 20 years old, from 19 years old, having the audacity and the courage to think that I could do that thing, and then setting out to do it, and then actually learning, well, I do have a voice. Well, I can actually write a narrative and a lyric and I can put it together, well, I can actually, I can use that voice and I can do really good things with it and entertain people and possibly move people emotionally, which is, that's what I go to music for. That's what I want when I go to music. So that's what I try to provide, you know?
Well, listen, I mean, you have provided it above and beyond for many, many years. And we, you know, from music to your art, to your photography, do you know what I feel when I opened this book is I was like, I can't wait to see who is chiming with Michael as who's interesting next. You know, I think that's because you've always been the barometer of that for me and for so many people. And it was so lovely to see the faces and the lists and the names. It's just really exciting and it embodies a moment.
Are you a list maker as well, Chris? Because you suggested earlier that that's something that's important to you.
Obsessed. People say that creative people don't make lists. And I'm like, all I do is make lists.
I don't make lists as much as I think them. I think in lists.
Right.
And then I have to write it down or I'll forget it, which iPhones are really good for. But yeah, the book has, you know, if my greatest dream could come true, there would be people in this book whose names people don't recognize and they wonder who they are and they do a search on DuckDuckGo or on Google or on Yahoo or on whatever your search engine is. They do a search and they find out why this person might have made it into a Michael Stipe book of portraits and what's important to me during this bizarre period that we're moving through about Ivy Arce, let's say, for example. Or Claude Cahun, who, you know, when I discovered her, how would Claude Cahun reference, how would she identify if she was 14 years old in 2021? Wow, that just blows my mind to think about that. Because she was so radical lesbian, like radical for the time period. She was radical during Nazi Germany with a really? Shaved head and a girlfriend and like totally open and totally public about it. And I mean, Janet Flanner, same thing. Incredible. The amazing Janet Flanner. So there's a lot of good people in that book.
The thread that pulls them all together is they are, you know, brave and representing the future, even if it was in the past, I suppose. The bright new dawn that we all need.
Yeah, and fierce, which feels like a word from 10 years ago, you know, but I'm okay using it here because it really actually applies.
Yes. And I'm aware we've got to get you off to dinner. I just wanted to ask, what's next? What's next for you?
I've actually gone back to music and I'm writing and composing songs right now with a variety of people, all of whom I'm super excited about. I don't want to mention by name, but one of them, Andy LeMaster, I've worked, there's a few songs. If you go to michaelstipe.com, there's a couple of songs that I released over the past year and, gave my first year's earnings to Extinction Rebellion and to,
Pathway to Paris. I love them.
Thank you. I'm really proud of the videos for those songs. Make me super, very excited. And a song that I wrote with, a song called No Time for Love Like Now that I wrote before COVID that weirdly mentions lockdown and talks about a timeless space. I was referring to the Bardo, but the song feels weirdly prescient to what we find ourselves in now. And now that we're not post COVID certainly, but we're now in the post vaccine or we're in mid vaccine. Hopefully a lot of the more optimistic things that we've talked about today will come to light and we can find ourselves focusing on these much more important, these other incredibly important issues that we need to address immediately.
Yes, 100%. Michael, this has been such a joy. You are an absolute hero of mine and I adore you. And this has just been the most wonderful chat. So thank you so, so much for giving us your time.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a real pleasure to be on and talking to you and good luck in the outback. I wrote a song once about, I know Adelaide, but I wrote a song once about Adelaide.
Did you?
I did. It's called Parakeet and it's about a domestic violence situation and this woman imagining that she's flying off to a place where cats can't hurt birds. But I think in the song I refer to Adelaide as Brisbane. I got the two cities mixed up, which I'm a bit embarrassed about, but it was Adelaide. Adelaide is what I wrote it about. So it's a beautiful song. Check it out. It's really beautifully written. Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm going to go and listen to it literally now. Nutritious and delicious. That's what I would call Michael's type. What a joy to listen to. Did anyone else Google the incense he was talking about? I did. Tried to get some. Yes. What a refreshingly wonderful man. So kind. You know, one of the things I loved that he said was talking about redefining his gender identity now and the kindness with which he speaks, actually. And also the way that he sort of paused and said, can I just talk about the sort of Skype etiquette here? I just think that's so lovely. And I think it's weirdly something that people don't do enough of. And I think it's really nice to sort of just say, can I just pause? Because it's sort of awkward, but it actually means the conversation goes better later from that point forwards. So I will be doing a Skype on all my future Zooms and just saying, hello, was it a Zoom or a Skype? Sorry, probably got the name wrong. Hello, would it be okay if I just do a little bit of housekeeping as who's going to nod and who's not going to nod? Yeah, hope you had a lovely dinner. Hope you guys enjoyed listening to that as much as I did. Please write to us and let us know what you think of it. Hello at homosapienspodcast.com or on Instagram at Homo Sapiens. If there's anything that came up for you in that interview that you'd love, please let us know. Please tell us about it. I'd love to know more. Stay in touch. As always, write us your agony uncles. They always remain anonymous. Write to us with your thoughts about other episodes, with your questions. They shall be replied to. And please, if you like this episode, go to Apple Podcasts, rate and review, and you could be in with a chance of winning a Homo Sapiens t-shirt if you get picked for review of the week. And if you want to buy a t-shirt, with all proceeds going to the Albert Kennedy Trust at the moment, it is everpress.com/Homo Sapiens. You can get yourself a beautiful t-shirt there. You can also get yourself a wonderful sweatshirt. I wear both all the time because I don't like to think about what I have to wear. I just wear a uniform. All right, listeners, you've been a delight. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. Loads of love and goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Powered by Spirit Studios.